Welcome to the Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Ian Rankin is the multi-million copy worldwide best-selling author of over 30 novels and creator of John Rebus. His books have been translated into 36 languages and have been adapted for radio, the stage, and screen. Rankin's latest, Midnight in Blue, is his 25th novel in the Rebus series. John Rebus spent his life as a cop putting Edinburgh's most deadly criminals behind bars. Now, having been convicted of a homicide, he has joined them. Rankin is the recipient of 4 Crime Writers Association Dagger Awards, including the Diamond Dagger, the UK's most prestigious award for crime fiction. In the United States, he has won the celebrated Edgar Award and has been shortlisted for the Anthony Award. It is a great pleasure to welcome Ian Rankin to the Book Show this week. Thank you very much for being with us. A delight to have you here.
Thank you, Joe. That was some reception I just got there.
Well, I'll tell you, and I left out, like, sort of buried the lead here. But you were just knighted last year. Congratulations. You are Sir Ian Rankin. What a lovely, lovely thing to have happened, not only for your work as a writer, but for your philanthropy. And I assume it's hard to process something like that.
It is. It is hard to process. And as I do, living in Edinburgh, I'll only ever be the second best known Edinburgh detective writer because, of course, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was born and raised in Edinburgh, although he chose not to set his stories here. So I'm catching him up. Now that he's a sir, I'm a sir. Maybe I'm getting that a little bit closer to Arthur Conan Doyle.
What is it like to be brought into that? Not something that you ask for, right? It comes out of the blue, I assume.
It comes out of the blue. It was the Queen, Her Majesty the Queen's Platinum Jubilee. That's how long she'd been on the throne of the UK. She decided certain people should be given honours, should be given medals and what have you, and I was one of them. So it was an amazing thing. It was for me, it was a real coup because so few contemporary crime writers, mystery writers, have been honoured that way. So yeah, it was a big deal. It was a big deal.
It just seems a lovely thing to have happened. And now, Rebus, make sure I'm right on this, Ian, but I've read both that this is the 25th and or the 26th Rebus novel. But at 25, is that your count?
Yeah, 25 is my count.
Yeah. As far as that goes, I mean, that's just a number, but it's a nice round number in the sense of 25 books that you've been doing this character, and I'm curious of what, if anything, that means to you or allows you to think about in terms of your legacy and the character's legacy.
Well, I mean, I've known this guy longer than I've known most of my friends. I've known this guy for almost as long as I've known my wife. We've been hanging out together for quite a while. And I made the decision early on that he would live more or less in real time. So he has changed a lot, as I have, during the course of these decades we've spent together. And I thought it was, you know, several times in the course of the last 30 years, I thought I was done with him. I thought, this is it. This is as far as I can take you. But he seems to find a way to manipulate his way back into my life and back onto the page. So, for example, the previous book, Heart Full of Headstones, ended with Rebus basically at the top of the Reichenbach Falls. He's been accused of murder. He's in a courtroom. Sentence is about to be pronounced. I thought, what a great ending to the series. That would be a great ending to the series. But fans disagreed. They said, so what happens next? What happens to him in that courtroom? And I thought about it and thought about it. I thought about it. Well, he's obviously found guilty. If he's found guilty, he goes to prison. Suddenly, I've got an ex-cop in prison in Edinburgh, surrounded by people who hate his guts because he's an ex-cop. And some of those people he put in there. So you've got tension and drama from the get-go. And then I thought, okay, I'm interested in this. You've got me interested now. And you've got a guy who is not only an ex-cop, but he's in his 70s. He's got health issues. How is he going to cope in prison? So it just, it was tantalizing for me to take him into that environment. and then to give him something to do.
And it seems you wanted less to do with the courtroom aspect of it, of how he got there and how it happened. This book opens with he's there. He's in jail.
Yeah, I mean he's in jail. I mean he's he, you know the so, some several months have passed since the end of the previous book, so he's been found guilty. He's been put in prison. And when I was doing the research for this book, I was able to go to Edinburgh Prison and talk to the governor. And I said, I laid out the pitch. I pitched the book to him, and he said, "Let me stop you there. Rebus wouldn't come here. You would not send an Edinburgh detective to an Edinburgh jail. It's too dangerous." I said, "Well, I've really wanted to come here. I don't want to go anywhere else." I said, "If he did come here, what would happen?" He said, "Well, if he came here, he'd be put into a kind of high security unit where he would be separated from the general prison population. So he'd be in with people who were either a danger to themselves or a danger or would be at danger if they were in the general population." I said, "Okay, fine, I can live with that." And then I managed to finesse, find a way where he would come out of that very claustrophobic environment into the kind of wider prison because he's under the protection of a gangster. And then I thought, okay, there's a murder. A murder happens in prison. I'm a huge fan, Joe, of a subgenre of crime fiction or mystery fiction called the locked room mystery. I
Yes.
love a good locked room mystery. And Edgar Allan Poe was an early proponent of this. Murder in the Rue Morgue is one of the first locked room mysteries. I thought, what if you've got a locked cell mystery? You know, the cells are locked in the morning. There's a prisoner there, dead. There's no sign of the murder weapon. We don't know what happened. There's one guy in that jail who might find out what the truth is and stop all the prisoners and all the prison officers from clashing because one side thinks the other side must have done it. That's Rebus. So suddenly, from being in danger for his life, he's the kind of savior in a way. He's the guy who can bring
Right.
order to this jail. So it just fitted into place really easily.
There is such a mystery to it. And not only that, but as we're trying to figure it out, Rebus is trying to figure it out and then becomes kind of the level head of, oh, this guy is the one person who probably can help us out because he was right across the hall.
Yeah, and he's a born detective. Being a detective has meant he hasn't had to think too deeply or hard or long about himself and his own failings as a human being. In prison, in a cell on his own, he's got nothing to do but think about all the mistakes he made in his life, all the ways he could have been a better person, a better human being, a better man, a better father, a better husband. Suddenly, they give him a job to do, and he switches straight back into detective mode, which he loves. He enjoys being a detective. So that was a lot of fun, a lot of fun for me. And by the way, when I started writing this book, as usual for me, I had no idea how this locked cell mystery was going to resolve. I didn't know how it was done. I didn't know who the killer was. As Rebus was finding out stuff, I was finding it out alongside him. Now that's a high risk strategy for a novelist, but it's always worked for me in the past, and so I continue to live by it.
Ian Rankin is our guest. The name of the new book is Midnight and Blue. It is published by Mulholland Books. And then there is another crime, a crime on the outside that runs along with this that is being worked on, and that allows you some space and out of the prison.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, absolutely. It was going to be an incredibly claustrophobic book if it had just been set in that jail, and actually quite a short book as well. But because the governor of the jail in Edinburgh told me, look, if there's a murder in this prison, detectives from outside, detectives that Rebus would have worked alongside at one time, would come in here to solve it. It's not like it's a special unit of officers who would solve the crime. It's officers from the outside, from the normal CID detective unit in Edinburgh. I thought, great. So when they leave the prison, we can leave with them. The readers can leave with them, and I can leave with them. We can get some fresh air. We can get some space. And then I found another mystery that would allow me to introduce other characters from Rebus's past, other detectives he's worked with. So as a missing person, a teenage girl was gone missing. We don't know what happened to her, but it looks likely eventually that her case might tangentially tie in to the murder in the prison. So you've got the outside world and the inside world. And then Rebus has that connection because the cops on the outside have a guy on the inside. So they would like him to help them solve the mystery. And he's also interested in the case of the missing person. So yeah, it all came together. And it was a relief for me to be able to leave that environment because it is an incredibly suffocating, stifling environment. And all the many times, and Joe, I've only ever gone as a visitor, only as a visitor, but there are many times I've visited prisons all across the world. It's always a relief when you leave. You see the world with fresh eyes when you've been locked up and you suddenly get to walk out and you go, my goodness, so many people in that building cannot walk out. They have just walked out.
And I assume it makes you think as a crime writer of how the people got there in the first place, and how right you have to get it to make sure that they are there for the right reasons.
Sure. And I mean, that's another thing about my guy Rebus is in the past, he's not always been a good guy. He has sometimes put people in jail because he thought they deserved to be in jail, even if he's had to skew evidence against them. So he's not always been whiter than white. So in this prison environment, he's meeting people who'd say, I shouldn't be in here. And he's going, yeah, maybe you shouldn't. Maybe, because I know I've put people in jail who hadn't committed the crime necessarily. So all of that is going on. Also, you've got people in prison he finds who have mental health issues, who
Yeah.
are frail, who are elderly. If there was another place for them to go, hospital or a care home, that's where they should be, but there is no other place for them to go. Then you get the people who become used to prison life. So when they leave prison, they cannot cope with the chaos of the outside world, the unstructured nature of the outside world, and they commit further crimes just to go back in to a place where they feel safe and looked after and there's some structure to their life. So I'm introducing them to all these different reasons why people are in jail, the reasons why people keep going back into prison, and some of the people who, in a better world, would not need to be in that place. So, as with all my previous books, I'm having a conversation with this guy, Rebus, about the way the world is, and I'm trying to show him that there is nuance. Although he's an Old Testament guy at heart, he sees the world in absolutes, good and evil, black and white. I'm trying to say to him, look, there are gradations, there are shades, there are nuances here. And trying to get him to accept that that's the case.
You write about contraband coming into the prison. He learns very early, Rebus learns very early about where the drugs are coming from, who's high, how they got it, what the network is. There's phones in the prison, other things, and figures that out, which I assume most prisoners do, figure it out pretty quickly.
Yeah, there was a myth which was perpetuated by those in power in the UK that there were no drugs in prisons. No, a prison is a fairly open, there's a conduit. There are various ways that you can get stuff in, whether it's weapons, whether it's phones, or whether it's drugs, they can all get in. And they do. And I've tried to play fair. The prison in Edinburgh, it's a real prison that I've set the book in. So I've tried to play fair and said, look, the potential for this to happen is there. To the extent it happens, I've got no idea how much gets in, how it gets in. But I've given the here are some theories of how this stuff gets in. And look, if you're in prison and there's not enough staffing, then you're not getting to go out to your education stuff. You're not getting to go to the library. You're not going to go to the rec room or the yard the way you used to, because there's not enough people there to keep an eye on you. You tend to get locked up for long periods of time. When you're locked up for long periods of time, you start taking drugs. If drugs are available, you'll take them. It stops you going mad. It stops you from being locked in these four walls. I mean, that prisoner, a gangster early on, says to Rebus, look, I can give you something. These walls
Right.
will disappear if you start taking this stuff. And Rebus is reluctant to go down that route, but he can understand why a lot of people would go down that route. So yeah, it's the potential is there for all this stuff to happen. Whether it happens or not, I can't say.
If you and I were friends and you went to prison and I went to visit you, I don't know that I would know necessarily how to communicate with you because our friendship would have changed. You're on the inside, I'm on the outside, especially if we're both police officers. And you deal with that. It's really interesting because there's some characters that say, okay, I'm going to accept you and I hope you get out and I assume that this is going to happen. However, and then there's also if you're in here, there's got to be something.
Yeah. Well, there's a guy, a character I've used in various of my books called Malcolm Fox.
Right.
When I retired Rebus the first time round, after Exit Music, I introduced this character, Malcolm Fox. I still want to write about cops, but I didn't want readers to feel that we're getting Rebus 2.0. So this guy Fox was good for me because he's the antithesis of Rebus. He's a cop who investigates other cops and brings them down if they're crooked. So he's the kind of cop who would have investigated Rebus in the past. So in this book, Rebus is finally in jail, the place where Malcolm Fox thinks he should have been all the way along. So Fox gets a chance to come into the prison because of the murder and look for Rebus so he can gloat, so he can look him in the eye and go, "I got you eventually," even though he didn't really get him. But also there are other cops like Christine Essen, who's investigating the murder, Siobhan Clark, who was Rebus's one-time colleague. And Siobhan visits Rebus in the jail. She goes to the visiting room and sits with him. And sometimes Rebus's daughter comes in. He's very adamant. He does not want his granddaughter to see him in that place. And that's because, having talked to lots of prisoners, they don't always want their family to come in, because they don't, when they get out, they don't want their family to remember that they were actually in there in the first place and think of them that way. So all of that's going on. And yeah, it adds a human touch. It adds an emotional, it gives an emotional heft, I think, to the story. It's hopefully not just a puzzle, not just a mystery story. It's a story of human interaction and what prison does to people.
I thought there was a beautiful scene in the book where Rebus's daughter comes and he doesn't want to see his granddaughter. He says he doesn't want to see his granddaughter. And his daughter says, but she wants to remember you. She wants to know who you are. And then there's an exchange of a drawing that he treasures and then is a part of the book because he holds on to it. And that's sort of that talisman from that moment that he has, that he's very proud of, and believes that she's a prodigy as a result of the picture that she has drawn. That does get very personal and really a sweet moment in the novel.
It is. When I invented Rebus, I invented him to be a hard-nosed detective. He's uses his muscularity, his heft, to intimidate people, to threaten them, to get confessions from them, or whatever. But when I invented this guy, he was 39, 40 years old. He's now in his 70s and he's not got that heft anymore. When he retired and he suddenly got health issues, he knows that mortality is coming for him. And so he wants to make connections with his daughter. He'd been estranged from his daughter for many years. He wants to make a connection. Then he meets his granddaughter and then he starts to make a connection there as well. And as he gets older, these human connections mean much more to him, as I think they do to all of us. As we get older, we cling to our friendships and our family because we know that none of this stuff is forever. When you're young, you're immortal. As you get older and health becomes an issue, then suddenly you go, you're not immortal. What do you leave behind? And what impressions of you are going to be left behind? All of that is being dealt with, hopefully, in this book. And that's one of the things I've enjoyed about writing about Rebus in real time, is that he has changed. And so when I sit down to write a new book, I'm not writing about the same guy I was writing about 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago. His life has moved on, and I've got to relearn who he is again. And I find that absolutely fascinating. And also, of course, I've given to him a lot of the issues that I'm going to have to deal with as I get older. I mean, as Leonard Cohen said, "I ache in the places where I used to play." And Rebus is going through that ahead of me. Yeah, he's got COPD, he's got a pulmonary disease. So he can't climb stairs. He's got to have a nebulizer with him at all times, all that kind of stuff. And so he's dealing with mortality and he's teaching me how to deal with mortality.
When you look at it as him teaching you, I mean, obviously, without giving anything away, but I mean, you've set this book up for an obvious that you'll keep going. It seems pretty clear there'll be a 26
No,
book.
really?
I think so. And I assume, even as if you don't know where it's headed, that you I get I don't know how far you think out, but you got an idea of where you what trouble you can get into? No?
No, I've got no idea, man. As I sit talking to you, I've got no idea for another book. My wife is very keen that I either slow down or stop, and we start enjoying life while we've still got our wits about us and we've still got use of our limbs. I mean, the previous book I thought was a pretty good ending for a series. This book, I think, is a pretty good ending for a series. There's never been a plan. Joe, from book one, there's never been a plan. I killed this guy. At the end of book one, first draft, he died. I thought there's only ever going to be one book with this guy. And then having decided, oh no, he wouldn't die, he'd just be wounded, but he'd be okay. I went off and did other things. I wanted to be a spy writer, I wanted to be a thriller writer. I came back to Rebus because my editor said, what happened to that guy? I liked that guy. And I thought, okay, there's more I can do with him. And every time I tried to kill him off, he seems to, it's like Sherlock Holmes. He just seems to bounce back. But what do you do with a guy? He's in his 70s. He's got health issues. He's no longer a cop. He's not been a cop for a long time. The challenge for me with Rebus in retirement is how can I keep it realistic to the reader that this guy would become involved in a criminal investigation? It's getting tough.
So with that said, there's also, I mean, there are market forces out there, as you well know, Ian. This is a television program. You've got the play, you've got books. So there are people, even after he lived, after that first book, now people slowly but surely the audience grows and grows and grows, and people want more Rebus and they want more Ian. So, how does that factor into the discussion for you?
Well, you're right. There's a stage play tour in the UK at the moment called Rebus, a game called Malice. And I had a lot of fun writing it. And it's getting great audiences. People are loving it as it tours the UK. And I quite like seeing Rebus in three dimensions. I quite like seeing him on a stage. And it's more of an Agatha Christie style whodunit. Within 90 minutes, you've wrapped the whole thing up. But that was fun. So maybe there's going to be more to that. But that is set with a Rebus who's only just retired. Then is a TV. The TV adaptation is Rebus as a young man, so Rebus in his early 40s, but set in the present day. So that's a very different Rebus again. And then we've got the Rebus I write about who's in his 70s. They all seem to exist and they all do quite well almost without my input. I had almost no input into the TV show. The drama goes on, the play goes on without me having to be in the audience every night. I don't know, man. It's kind of weird. And the thing we all know this, is that great characters outlive their creators. I mean, Sherlock Holmes outlived his creator, Poirot, Miss Marple, even Inspector Morse. They outlive their creator. So Rebus can be going way after I've shuffled off this mortal coil. As long as I'm having fun and I can find things to do with them that remain interesting to me and realistic, yeah, there might be something else, but it might not be a novel. It might be another stage play.
Because you could easily go back and say, and maybe not easily, but go back and say, all right, here is a case that Rebus did when he was in his 40s or 50s. You could do that, but that's different too, isn't it? That's going against pretty much everything you've set up.
Yeah, until recently, I would have said I would never do that because those would be historical novels, and historical novels need a lot of research, need a lot of work done on them. What were people wearing in the 70s or 80s? I can't remember. What were they drinking? How much did a drink cost? How much was a mortgage? What kind of cars were you driving? What shows were on TV? What was in the cinema? I've got no idea. I'd have to do all the research on that. But during the COVID lockdown, I was approached by the widow of a great Scottish novelist called William McIlvany, who was not a mentor to me, but he'd written three crime novels featuring a guy called Laidlaw, set in Glasgow in the late 70s, early 80s, which were hugely important to me when I was starting out in this industry. He had started the book and then died before it was finished, and she asked me if I would complete it. And that book was set in 1972. And so I became a historical novelist. And it was a lot of fun. And do you know what made it fun? The thing that made it fun, you didn't have to factor in cell phones, CCTV, closed cameras, interviews that were being recorded, everybody with a phone on them. So if they're being abducted, they can just video it or just put find my phone and suddenly they're found in 30 seconds. So the criminal stuff, the investigation was much more straightforward. It was a game of wits. And it was about using your contacts, your on-street contacts, and your intellect to solve the crime, not technology. And I really liked that. So maybe, I'm not promising, but maybe there's room for a Rebus novel set in the 70s or 80s in which we can get rid of all that technology and get back to good old-fashioned storytelling.
You kind of toy with that just a little bit in this novel where there's just a camera that just doesn't work. I mean, that's the other thing. Technology doesn't always have to work, does it?
Well, you know what? I mean, A, there's a crime is taking place in a prison cell. For God's sake, the cameras can't work. If they work, then I'm screwed, you know? So I had to get rid of the cameras. The cameras had to go. But then I read an article in a newspaper about some cameras that weren't working in a prison in England, and they hadn't been working for 6 months. So it's realistic that one camera might have gone down for a week or so, just at the same time that this murder was taking place. But yeah, you're right. All that tech, you've got to factor it in. You've got to factor in the cell phones and the cameras and the this and the that, and the fact that we're all under surveillance all the time. And it's really boring to write about. So you've got a murder in the community, and all your cops are going around doing doorstepping and interviewing people. You know, can we just check the footage from your Ring doorbell? Can we just check the victim's cell phone and triangulate it, and when did they last do it? And you go, oh, it's so boring. But you've got to give a sense that that's actually going on somewhere, even if you're not really interested in it.
Did you feel the same way about forensics?
Forensics is fascinating to me, but again, yeah, you've got to factor it in because every reader now thinks they know what happens and what's available to a police force. It ain't always so. CSI did a lot of damage because a lot of stuff that CSI on television did was either fictitious and could never happen in the real world, or real world police forces couldn't afford to do it, or it would take months to do. Couldn't be done in 45 minutes of television. So yeah, that was a bane in my life for a while. But I do, I mean, I like talking to scientists. I do like talking to scientists about changes that have taken place in DNA analysis, or even just crime scene analysis, or the details you can get from a body, from a cadaver. That's all changed. And again, that's interesting for me, but I've got to persuade the reader that I know what I'm talking about, even if I don't really know what I'm talking about.
Again, Ian Rankin's new novel is Midnight in Blue. It is published by Mulholland Books. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LaDuke. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.